Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
When we only have an army of 70,000 and we can't recruit to it, there is something seriously wrong. There are no shortage of young men and women who want to join the army.
Regardless of who stands with Israel, Israel will fight until this battle is won.
I've made wartime decisions. I know the choices are never clear or easy for the leadership.
I just find bombs and I find dead people, but it's a really scary thing for me.
I'm David Knowles, and this is a bonus episode of Battle Lines. 2 years of full-scale warfare in Europe and a host of emerging conflicts around the world are giving many governments pause for thought. What should an army look like in the 21st century? What components or kit should it have? And how much should we be spending? And are we spending enough? Telegraph contributor and former soldier Hamish de Breton Gordon has been asking these questions for years. I caught up with Hamish after he attended a special conference on exactly this question. Here's our conversation. Well, Hamish, thank you so much for your time. Can you start just by explaining where you've been today, what event you're at?
Yes, hi, everybody. Today I've been at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, which is one of the more significant military think tanks and political think tanks in this country. And there, an organisation called the New Bletchley Movement have produced a paper on what they call the New Model Army, what we need to do. They title it Rebuild the Army Now to Prepare, to Prevent, to Deter War. And the sort of people involved in it, it's very significant across the spectrum of military, academic, political and civil servant. So led by Lord Robertson, George Robertson, who was Defence Secretary and then head of NATO, Sir Richard Barron's former four-star commander, Professor Michael Clark, used to be head of RUSI, also a number of journalists, people like Deborah Haynes from Sky, a number of other generals, Lord David Richards, who used to be the chief of the defence staff, General Sir Richard Sharif, who used to be deputy commander of NATO, and Lord Mark Sedwell, who was a former cabinet secretary and national security advisor. So a wide look at people, and really the exam question they were asked is, where are we with defence? And really, what do we need to do to have a credible army, as in land-based deterrent, going forward, given everything that's happening around us?
Well, let's start that discussion then from your observations of this meeting. Can we start by talking about, as you've described it, threat perception, the threat perspective of Britain's place in the world and what our allies and our, you could say, geopolitical rivals are doing? Where are we in 2024?
The threat picture is multifaceted. I only reported the other day about the 36th anniversary of the Halabja gas attack in northern Iraq, when Saddam Hussein basically tried to eradicate the Kurdish race with chemical weapons, kill 5,000 people on the 21st of March, 1988. It was another 15 years before we got rid of Saddam Hussein using British tanks, which no longer exist. Then we had the tyrant President Assad in Syria, supported by the Iranians, again, actually using chemical weapons, but killing thousands of civilians, supported by the Iranians, but actually still in power. Both the Halabja gas attack and what happened in Syria, we turned a blind eye. Now, we still have those threats in the Middle East. What I would say, and I think what we discussed at RUSI, is that they are horrific, but they're not really immediate. What the main threat is, and I think maybe it's people like me, so-called experts, are not explaining it clearly enough to the people of this country, that we have a modern-day Hitler, a tyrant in Europe, determined to head west, with no boundaries. Now he has been elected by allegedly 87.5% of his people, who wants to basically redraw the Soviet Union borders, or Peter the Great, as he likes to sort of frame himself, of dominating Europe. And that is the most immediate thing. And he is spending 6% of his gross domestic product on defence. He is turning his tractor factories into tank factories. Basically, he is conducting what we'd call a total war. The whole economy is focused on the war and the people. 600,000 troops in Ukraine at the moment, and more to come and backfill it. And that is the threat to us. It's not the thousands of miles away in the Middle East or the Far East. It's the hundreds of miles away in Europe. And that is the perspective. And that's where we look at it. So when we look at our defense deterrent, our nuclear deterrent, in my opinion, is highly effective and has done his job. But our conventional deterrent has not. And really, since the end of the Cold War, we have let it drift. We focused on being able to project maritime power at great distance. We have two wonderful aircraft carriers that cost, I don't know, the thick end of £10 billion. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But they were there, or they are there, to project power in the Far East and the high seas. We have capable air force, air power, predominantly to protect the homeland. But we're also seeing them now attacking the Houthis. Interestingly enough, not using aircraft carriers, but using some of our bases. So when we come to what the real threat is, we've discussed in Europe, we have our land force. And that is what has been allowed to drift, what's been hollowed out, what's been underinvested really since the end of the Cold War. So is no longer a deterrent to Putin. And it is something that we really need to get very quickly. Because if not, and if things like if Trump is elected, which is looking increasingly likely, if what he's saying at the moment he does, and that's not a guarantee by any means, but if he creates Fortress America at the cost of stopping or holding Putin in Europe, then we are going to be fighting, you know, in the fields and ditches and hedgerows of Europe. But at the moment, we don't have the capability to do that.
You've mentioned it briefly there. It might be good to speak a little bit more about that, because the event you're describing is obviously a sort of a meeting of the great and the good of the British defence space. You mentioned sort of one potentially unreliable ally if the election of President Trump does happen. How else would you characterise, and how else did this event characterise our or Britain's allies and friends around the world? Where is, to what extent is, do you think people are sort of waking up to this idea that maybe NATO isn't the most reliable stopgap that we have? Maybe we should be looking out for our own, if I can put it as bluntly as that.
Yeah, no, that is a really good point. And I think we also have unreliable allies in Europe, part of NATO. And certainly the Germans are of a concern to us, but they have the capacity to turn that around. The French tend to be ambiguous. The beginning of the war, Macron is appeasing Putin. He's now trying to attack him, and his boots on the ground in Ukraine thing has really got people going. I actually think he's right. I think Putin should at least think that we might put boots on the ground in Ukraine. But yeah, the NATO with the US driving it forward is not necessarily something we can guarantee beyond November. So I think it's very much that we need to look at the force structures in Europe. The addition of the Finns and the Swedes is very positive. They are very capable. They have the potential to turn their regular force, which is relatively small, about the same size as our British force, into a hugely larger force supported by conscription and reserves. Over 1 million Finns are trained and ready to go. If we look at our own case, you know, we're talking in the not even the tens of thousands. So I think that there is the hardware and also the manpower in Europe to be able to do this. But the critical role that Britain should play, and we have catch up to do. A lot of people in Europe are still very sore about the whole Brexit debate. A lot of people are very concerned about that Britain can easily sit back on our little island and let the Europeans fight it out with the Russians. what we don't have in hard power, as it were, that is tanks and all the rest of it. We still have in the leadership and command and conceptual role. And I think that is what we were discussing today, is that Britain really needs to step forward there. We still have the ability to bring people and forces together and to help command and control them. This is one of the weaknesses in a way that, or one of the things that Ukraine is slightly suffering from. The bravest men and women in the world, they've got the kit, they need more ammunition. What they're lacking sometimes is the ability to put it all together and fight not in what I call onesies and twosies, but fight as a cohesive force. Now, that is no fault of their own. This is something that NATO has been training at for years and years. But axiomatically at the moment, we in Britain can do it on a blackboard, if you like, in a classroom, and we still have great thinkers and know how to do it, but we don't have the hardware to do it. Conversely, of course, people like the Finns and the Swedes have the hardware, but not necessarily the experience to tie it together. And that's really where we think Britain comes in, still in that role. But in order to have our seat at the table, we need to have mass. We need to have a credible land force to put down there in what we call the first echelon. The first echelon is your regular, highly professional force that really meets the enemy first. And if they don't succeed, you then need to follow on. And we've seen that in Ukraine. We've seen it with the Russians. The Russian first echelon, the Russian elite force, was all destroyed and killed within about 8 months, which is now why all they really appear to be doing is throwing manpower into the meat grinder and lots of dumb ammunition and all the rest of it. So the Russians are definitely beatable, but it needs a coherence approach. And there is a feeling that Britain can do this, but is not really configured to do it. And certainly there doesn't seem to be the political will or the financial backing to make it happen. But if it doesn't, and there is a view that possibly Ukraine might falter this summer, and tying in with what's happening in the States, then if we don't get onto this now, then we could be back to fighting in the fields in Europe soon.
Well, let's get into some of the detail then, I think. If we were to remake the British Army, I mean, as you mentioned, you said we've got very good maritime capabilities, very good air force. It's the conventional land forces that need work. What could the proposals be? What might that look like? What should, do you think, the British should be investing in? Are there any new capabilities, things we might have learned, for example, from the Ukraine war or elsewhere? So what new things might we see in a buildup of conventional arms and personnel in the British Army?
There are an awful lot of things we could discuss here. I'll try and keep it to what I think are really the most important elements we look at. First of all, is what we call the people side of it, the manpower, the men and women in the army. Now, it is very clear, and people have written in the paper, and I've written for the Telegraph recently, about the lack of investment in the people in the military. And I won't go into the details, but that they are the most important part of this. But when we only have an army of 70,000 and we can't recruit to it, there is something seriously wrong. There are no shortage of young men and women who want to join the army. But the way that the recruiting is going is just crazy. And actually, if you want to increase that, as we probably need to, then, you know, we have really fundamentally got to look at our people first. They're the most valuable asset. But at the moment, they are not being valued with terms and conditions of service, accommodation, and everything else that goes with it. And recruiting. I mean, the recruiting is an absolute disaster. That you know, it takes 18 months for a young boy or girl from expressing an interest to getting into the army. Now, my own son is 23. To him, that's a lifetime. And I know so many of his friends and children of friends of mine who've given up and gone to do other things because of that. So I think we have to sort out the people in the military. Then comes on to capabilities. A lot of the capabilities are the same. We just don't have very much. When I was a tank commander in the first Gulf War, we had, I think, 500 tanks on the inventory. We now have about 100, of which probably 30% we could put in the field. So, and that's a whole issue about the logistics support and everything else, because we've hollowed things out. In order to have a credible land army, I think most people would agree, and I would agree, we need to be able to put what we call an armored division into the field. What we did in both Gulf Wars, basically. And that gives us, along with the other armored divisions from the other NATO countries, gives us the punch and power to be able to prevail against the Russians. The second bit is kit. I mean, everybody is talking about drones. And drones are changing. They're not changing the battlefield. They're changing the way we fight. And, you know, fresh in my mind as I start to write a book about tanks, when if I was a tank commander in Cambrai in November 1917, I as a tank officer would be at the front with an ash plant checking the ground that was all right for the tank. Today's tank commanders have a drone doing that. At Cambrai in the First World War, I had a spotter in an air balloon finding targets. Today, I've got a drone that's at target end. So it's lots and lots of drones. And the interesting thing about drones is, again, mass is important. One of the discussions we had at RUSI today is actually, does this drone warfare, does that mean we need to create a new service, if you like? In simple terms, we have the Army, the Navy, and the Royal Air Force. We also now talk about space and cyber. But do we need a drone force? Because everything is so much detail to it. And of course, the British military have drones, but predominantly our drones are big and expensive. A Reaper drone, I think, costs about 10 to 15 million, but it's in the millions. You know, very capable. But if you lose one of those, you lose one. What we've seen in Ukraine is these sort of $500 drones. And a Reaper drone fires a Hellfire missile that will destroy a tank. But a $500 drone will drop a hand grenade through a hatch, which destroys a tank. If you lose a $500 drone, nobody's too fussed. You lose a $15 million drone. And again, the difficulty with all this is the procurement cycle, the length of it. So those drones, I was, as an army intelligence officer in Afghanistan back in 2007, 2008, we were introducing the first drones into service. And those same drones or newer variations are what we rely on now, you know, 15 years down the line. And it's that flexibility to change. So drone is going to be a key thing. Of course, the electromagnetic spectrum as well, and the whole cyber and IT stuff, which again is, you know, who controls the electromagnetic spectrum has a significant advantage. And it's, as we've discussed on the pod before, you know, it's no surprise that the Russians have a lot of what we call EW, electronic warfare assets, at the front, because they know if they can jam those drones or those missiles, then that is a lot easier than trying to knock them out of the sky. So there are a whole host of issues. And slightly going back to the manpower thing, you don't, you know, a soldier of today doesn't necessarily need to be 6 foot six and be able to lift heavy weights. Yeah, you still need those sort of people, but not necessarily. And again, I expect there are a lot of young boys and girls out there who don't consider themselves a career in the army for them. But actually, you know, some of the very clever, dare I say geeky without wanting to upset somebody, absolutely the people we need. So it's looking at it is in the whole. And the challenge with all this, and people say, you know, why are these old generals and politicians and others getting involved here? I mean, one of the things of hollowing out your military is that you hollow out a lot of the bits that are actually looking at the future and capability and force generation, the academia, if you like. I remember when I was sort of leaving the army, and I secured a place at Cambridge to do an MSc. And I was told, God, you don't want to waste your time doing that. You need to be soldiering. Now, sort of 10 years later, as a Cambridge academic, I can see I should have said, absolutely, this is the best use of my time. So I think that it's a whole variety of stuff, whole variety of capabilities, but it needs people looking at in depth. And the current military just doesn't have the resource or time, or I suppose in a way the energy to do it. The outgoing chief of the general staff, Patrick Saunders, you know, has had a sort of good go at it, but has got a slating from, you know, actually from a lot of people who really don't know what they're talking about. And it really goes back to the premise that we started with, that defence is not a political issue. A lot of people in this country don't see it as a significant issue. They would prefer to have cheaper bread and a couple of degrees off the planet. And they're right in a way. But unfortunately, if that means that Putin prevails in Europe, all that other stuff could become horrifically irrelevant.
Just a couple of questions before we finish. Everything you're describing, I mean, this is slightly amateur history from me, but a Britain with a highly professional army, which is quite small, which doesn't have the sort of the capability to put more than at least 70,000, 100,000 men in the field at any one time. Is this slightly back to the future? It sounds like we're describing, I mean, this sounds analogous to pre-World War One. Is that fair? Do you think maybe we haven't learned these lessons from, because that's something the British Army had to do in the First World War, is to spin up the ability to train and to re-equip and do everything like that.
Absolutely. It's somebody a lot brighter than me said, there's nothing new, it's just stuff we've forgotten. It's the same with the First World War, the same with the Second World War. Lots of people saying we're at 1939 or 1938. We're seeing this tyrant develop and there is no inertia, or there is too much inertia. We're doing nothing. We're not creating. I think it goes back to belief. Absolutely, we are in that position, you know, because if we have to fight in Europe as they did in 1914, we'll be in exactly the same position. We will get all the old soldiers in there and, you know, do what we can, chuck people to the front, a bit like Ukraine's done, and it'll be about holding on long enough till the second echelon can come through. And it was the same in absolutely the same in 1939 and 1914. So yeah, that absolutely we are repeating mistakes. But the corollary to that is, well, if there were no resource issues, we could afford not to repeat these mistakes. But it's very difficult for somebody like me to say to somebody who can't afford to eat 3 square meals a day that actually you need to pay a bit more tax so we can have a few more tank rounds. And conversely, those when we see these determined young and not just so young, you know, gluing themselves to the road because they're worried about climate change, I absolutely sort of get that. But then me saying, well, why worry about climate change that's going to affect the planet in 100 years time or fundamentally affect in 100 years time, where actually we could all be at war next year. And if a few nukes go bang, then, you know, climate change will be irrelevant. So there are so many competing things. Yes, we're repeating mistakes. Unfortunately, that's human nature.
Final question. Do you think anybody in power is listening?
Sadly, I don't think they are. I think politics is something that I dabbled with a few years ago. I was under the misconception that 650 best people in this country were politicians. And, you know, without wanting to sound overly harsh, I've now learned that is not the case. And unfortunately, politicians are human. And at the moment, all parties are looking at how they're going to get elected in November or whenever it is. And defence is not there. When I had a fascinating conversation with a director of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament yesterday, bizarrely, we thought the same. I abhor nuclear weapons, so does she. She doesn't think we have a viable conventional defence, and we should do, and I agreed with her. But what she said, fundamentally, young people in this country do not view defence, do not think that there is any chance that they're going to have to fight for their lives in Europe, as their forebears have done for generation and millennia. And on that basis, and on a political, we're now on this political pathway to an election, with defence not up there, I really fear nothing is going to change until I hope that Putin will be held, and we must do all we can to do that. But if he prevails, I don't think, and I don't think anybody who's looking at this seriously believes he's going to stop at Ukraine. And if the moment he steps one foot beyond Ukraine, we're all involved.
Thank you very much, Hamish.
Pleasure.
That's all for Battle Lines this time. Please join us again next week for more of The Telegraph's best foreign reporting. Goodbye.
Battle Lines is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our news, analysis and dispatches from around the world, subscribe to The Telegraph or sign up to Dispatches, which brings stories from our award-winning correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a live blog on our website where you can follow updates on Israel and Gaza as they come in throughout the day, including insight from contributors to this podcast. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Battle Lines on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it really helps others find the show. As disinformation is a particular problem during conflict, we are relying on your support more than ever. Battle Lines is part of wider Telegraph foreign coverage in our podcasts. If you're interested in finding out more about the war in Ukraine, you can listen to our sister podcast, Ukraine the Latest. Battle Lines is produced by David Degahi, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.